Hi, listeners. You can now listen to this community podcast production ad-free on Apple Podcasts and access the podcast 1 week early and get exclusive bonus content. Just hit the subscribe button now on Apple Podcasts. Or if you want access to all of the above, plus video versions of the podcast, head to patreon.com/stopthekilling.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
I'm Sarah Ferris, true crime podcaster.
And I'm Catherine Schweit, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program.
And you're listening to Stop the Killing. Well, welcome to another episode of Stop the Killing. I am so excited because we are joined again. Well, I say we. Catherine's actually not with me today. She's busy, I think, doing finals tests for her law students in Chicago. So I think I've probably got the better deal, to be fair. Because I am with the lovely Jodine Weber, who has joined us before on the podcast to discuss a very specific case. The Idaho 4 case. Now, Jodine, it's been a while. It's been a hot minute since we've had a chat. So would you introduce yourself to our listeners again? And then I think we need to have a little refresher on the Idaho 4 case as well.
Certainly. Thank you for having me back, Sarah. My name is Jodine Weber. I'm a retired special agent from the FBI. I spent 22 years with the FBI working various cases, terrorism, financial crimes, healthcare fraud, and I have my own podcast called Caught in My Web on patreon.com, and I cover true crime 5 days a week. So I have been very actively following the Idaho 4 case. And for those unfamiliar, in November 2022, in the middle of the night, approximately 4:04 a.m. until 4:20 a.m., four students, Kaylee Gonzalez, Madison Mogan, Ethan Chapin, and Zenner Kronodal, were murdered in their off-campus residence in the middle of the night. They were stabbed to death. In late December 2022, a man was arrested and charged with their killings. And so we have been following the prosecution since that time. And I understand you like to call the perpetrator and not name them. Is that correct?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so going forward, I will try to stick to the rules.
I know there's been a few developments recently that you wanted to update us on. So tell us what's been happening.
Absolutely, Sarah. There have been three major developments, and one development does involve sensationalistic coverage of this case. So we will get into that in just a minute. But first, I think the big news that just came out is that the perpetrator, his defense team, they were demanded to provide an alibi. In the state of Idaho, in the United States, the prosecution has the right to demand the defense provide an alibi. And what that allows is for the prosecution to know what will the perpetrator claim if they take the stand, where they were, what witnesses are there. And that gives the prosecution a chance to vet the information, determine its accuracy, interview potential witnesses, and prepare for trial, essentially. Well, they have tried three times to demand an alibi from the perpetrator. The first time, the defense came back and said, well, you'll learn that through cross-examination of witnesses. And the defense came back and said, no. If your client has an alibi, we need to know, where was he? What was he doing? Were there any witnesses to his activities? At what locations, at what times? Where was he? Well, then they came back a second time and they said that the perpetrator was driving around in the early morning hours. And again, the prosecution came back and said, well, where was he driving around? What was his route? When did he depart? When did he arrive back home, etc.? Give us a map. Tell us what locations he went to. Were there any witnesses in those locations? Well, finally, they came back again. And their deadline was this month, April 17th, to turn over an alibi. And now, again, it was once again vague. They said that the perpetrator was driving around. He was south and west of Moscow, Idaho, which is where the murders took place. And they said he drove to a park by the name of Wyawai Park, which is in Washington, very near his residence, and that he was out looking at the moon and stars. Now, many people found that the way this alibi was worded and the semantics, the verbiage in this alibi was very deceiving, because we know that the perpetrator's phone was on at 2:47 and then it lost connection to the network. And it was off for 2 hours and 1 minute, and then it regained connection to the cellular network at 4:48 a.m. And at that time, it was in a location south of Moscow, Idaho, taking a circuitous route back into Washington State. Now, along that circuitous route, the car and the phone went south of Moscow, then it went west into Washington, and then it did circle up back by this park. But what was missing from this third alibi that was submitted was the time that the perpetrator was allegedly at this park. Because if you don't say he was there between 4:04 and 4:20, you really don't tell us anything. That's what's key. Where was he during that time frame? Additionally, this alibi, it doesn't specify the perpetrator left his residence at approximately such and such a time. He proceeded southwest on this street and then traveled for approximately 1 mile before turning west. I mean, there's no details like that. And that is what is missing. Now, additionally, in this alibi, they claim he was looking at the moon and the stars. Well, I pulled the weather reports. There was ice fog and overcast condition. Basically, there is cloud cover. There was no stargazing that night. So I anticipate, if the prosecution is on their game, and I think they are, if and when we eventually get to trial, they will have a meteorologist who will testify that there was too much cloud cover to stargaze that night. Additionally, the one witness that the perpetrator plans to put on in support of his alibi is a cellular phone analyst. And I think what that phone analyst will say is that the phone wasn't turned off. It simply lost network connection, meaning it was out of range or there was geographical territory, mountains in the way type of thing. However, we still don't have the telematics or the computer data from the Elantra, from the car. And that will determine where the car was. So I think he's going to have a problem, because eventually that data from the car will be turned over as part of discovery, and that will pinpoint where he was between 4:04 and 4:20. So yeah, that's going to be hard. So that was a big deal, though, last week. That was a big development. And for the family of Kaylee Gonsalves, they came out and made a statement. And they said, you know what? We've been waiting over a year for this information. Where were you? And if your only answer is you were out gazing at the moon and the stars, why couldn't you say that a year ago? So it did not work in favor of the perpetrator. There is also a section in the alibi where the lead defense attorney says, well, the perpetrator's phone is off network at such and such a time. Therefore, the car that was seen on a video surveillance camera in front of this cannabis store can't be his, because the phone wasn't moving eastbound at that time. Well, when you go back and look at the times that are articulated for the phone in the probable cause affidavit, we already know the phone was off then. So you're not going to see the phone moving in conjunction with the car in front of this cannabis store at that time, because it's already off. It doesn't mean the phone's not in the car. We know the phone was in the car when he left his residence, and we know the phone is with the car when it turns back on at 4:48 and connects with the network. So it's with the car. It's just that it was turned off when it passes. So a lot of people picked up on that as well and felt that it was very misleading of the defense to word things that way. So that's our first big development in the case. Now, secondly, the defense has filed for a change of venue. And for those unfamiliar, that means they don't want the trial in Moscow, Idaho. They think it's tainted there. The jury pool is contaminated. There's been too much media coverage. Now, the prosecution argues that's baloney. There is global coverage of this case. Everybody's heard about this case. Yeah. And frankly, the big city in Idaho is Boise, Idaho. And the prosecution contends the coverage is even bigger down there because you have more larger television stations. You have more media outlets, so therefore you have more coverage. And social media is global. You can have coverage anywhere in the palm of your hand with your phone. So therefore, they think this change of venue is nonsense. Well, the defense filed the motion. So what they were doing in conjunction with their change of venue motion is they were conducting telephonic surveys. And what these telephonic surveys were designed to do was to gauge how much media exposure is there out there in the public lexicon. Are people tainted? Have they made judgments already about the perpetrator? And can he get a fair trial in Moscow, Idaho? Well, they started conducting this survey. And people getting these phone calls and being surveyed started getting concerned. So concerned, they called the police and they called the prosecution office. And they said, here are some of the questions that we're being asked. We're being asked, do we know about DNA on a knife sheath? Do we know that the perpetrator allegedly stalked one of the victims? Questions that are very detailed and specific and could potentially taint someone who is unfamiliar with the case, because by asking those specific questions, it plants in a person's mind the potential that this could possibly be true. Typically, surveys are done with open-ended questions, such as, have you heard about this case? What have you heard? What headlines have you read? Those sorts of things. Have you formulated an opinion? If so, what is it and why have you formulated that opinion? Things that don't suggest or plant information. So the prosecution got wind of these surveys, and there was a big, they immediately filed a motion, stop this, judge, we've got a problem. So the judge got this motion in. He immediately filed an order halting all surveys, prohibiting both the defense and the prosecution from making any comments until he could have a hearing. Well, the defense didn't like that. They're like, you're stopping us in our tracks. We need this for our change of venue. So there were two hearings on this, and they were quite contentious. And one of the things that came out is that the lead defense attorney, who has been whining in recent hearings about, I have to review everything. I have to review and read and understand everything for the perpetrator to make sure that his rights are protected. She gets in court and says, well, I never looked at the questions that the survey team is asking. And it's like, okay, you can't travel in two traffic lanes there. You either review everything or you don't. And isn't this coincidental that you didn't review these questions that are being asked? And now potentially jurors, potential jurors in Moscow, Idaho are getting these phone calls that have potentially tainting information in them. And are you essentially creating justification for a change of venue? It was a little too slick and a little too convenient. So we had two hearings. And on the second hearing, they had the actual person who conducts the surveys give testimony. And he was very defensive. And he said, look, I really don't appreciate being told I'm tainting a potential jury pool. I am doing my job. If you want me to gauge if there is taint or bias out in the community, I can't just ask open-ended questions because people don't volunteer everything they know. If I ask, have you heard about a case? People will volunteer, yeah, I've heard this factor or that factor, but they won't volunteer in totality all the things that they know about a case. It's only if you ask specifics, have you heard this, that people will say, oh, yes, I did hear that too. And then you get more into what they think. And so the judge is like, well, you're putting me in a very awkward position here because two of the questions you are asking are not truthful. There's lies. And you're potentially tainting potential jurors. That's problematic for me. And this surveyor said, I really don't care if it's true or not. If you want me to gauge bias, I've got to be able to ask this to see if people are biased. So it was very contentious. And he said, if I'm not allowed to ask what I want to ask, I'm not going to continue working with the defense. Well, the prosecution was up in arms. They were furious because they feel this was a setup, that all of this was done to guarantee that there will be a change of venue. Ultimately, the judge just ruled a couple days ago that he will allow the surveys to continue and that because all these questions were read in court, they are now part of the public record. And as long as the defense acknowledges that they want to keep going with this and they understand these questions could be prejudicial to their client, the judge is like, I'm not going to stop you. Now, the reason I think the judge is letting this go on is because he's worried about if the perpetrator is convicted, he's worrying about appeal and giving grounds for appeal. So this way, if the defense says, we don't care if this is not true, we want to go forward to see if people are biased, he's almost got to play into that hand and let them, because if they find people are biased, he wants to give them the change of venue to avoid that being grounds for appeal.
Complicated, isn't it?
It's very complicated. But what it did was it really shows how slick the defense will play and cut corners. And I mean, it got very contentious between the defense and the judge as well, because the defense accused the judge of violating the perpetrator's constitutional right to due process. And the judge was like, no, there's been no due process violation here. I've stopped the surveys temporarily. I notified you. I asked for your input. I'm hearing you out today. This is a delay. This isn't a stop or a halt or a cutting off of due process, but it got very testy. So we'll see. The prosecution obviously is not happy.
Hey, fellow true crime aficionados. I've stumbled upon the ultimate hidden gem, Dakota Spotlight by James Woolner. It's a revelation. Picture this. Thoroughly researched, original, and peppered with real interviews. No sensationalism here, just gripping storytelling with heart. You'll laugh, you'll cry, and you'll always want more. So cozy up and join me on the edge of your seat. Trust me, this podcast is the real deal. Start with the Manden murders and prepare to be hooked. Let's uncover this treasure together. Listen to Dakota Spotlight.
Have you ever felt that pang of disappointment when you couldn't add a ticket to your collection because it was digital? Or maybe you just lost it. Well, StubForge.com is here to change that. Imagine this, tickets that not only look but feel like the real deal. Because each ticket from StubForge is printed on the same quality stock that Ticketmaster uses and printed with genuine ticket printers. It's like holding a piece of the concert, the game, or the show right in your hands. But StubForge isn't just about replacing tickets. With the easy-to-use interactive designer, you can create custom tickets for anything, from concerts to sports games, pregnancy announcements, or parties. Why not make your invitations stand out with tickets that are as unique as your event? And if you're trying to complete a back catalogue of missing tickets, StubForge offers bulk discounts to make it both easy and affordable. With StubForge, you can once more give your loved ones physical tickets and see their eyes light up instantly at the best gift you can give. So whether you're looking to reignite your ticket collection, craft the perfect gift, or send the coolest invites, head over to StubForge.com. Start creating today and see how StubForge makes every ticket a story worth saving. Visit StubForge.com and start making tickets today.
Now that leads us to our third and final big event that has happened. Just yesterday, so this is hot off the press, the prosecution has filed for the next hearing, which is set for May 14th, to be held behind closed doors, to not be open to the public, which is highly unusual in the United States because our trials and court proceedings are open to the public. Now, in this filing that the prosecution filed yesterday, They say that there exists a compelling interest at stake to preserve a fair trial, and no reasonable alternative exists but to conduct a closed hearing. Now, I have two thoughts on why this is. Number one, it could be that the prosecutor is upset by what just happened with these surveys and feels that anything said in open court could become fodder and additional ammunition to use for a change of venue hearing, which is scheduled for the end of June. So therefore, he doesn't want anything said anymore in open court that could potentially be tweaked in the media or used by this surveyor to create even more false questioning. So that's possibility number one. Possibility number two is very interesting. There were two hearings held back last winter in January and February, and they were basically status updates on the case. And during these hearings, the lead defense attorney said, they were talking about what evidence still needs to be turned over. And this lead defense attorney said, you know, there's this video that the prosecution has that they haven't turned over yet. And the prosecution really, really likes it. And it is several days long. And the problem, the reason we have not received it, is because the audio and the video are not synced up on it. Now, when I heard that, based on my law enforcement experience, police body camera systems typically do not have audio and video synced for at least the first 30 seconds because they're manufactured that way. In order for police departments to protect privacy of people that they come upon at scenes, like, for example, when a cop comes upon a victim, what's your name? Where do you live? What's your date of birth? Are you injured? Do you have any medical issues? All of that is privacy information. So a lot of police departments will not buy body camera systems unless they have a built-in delay between their audio and their video. So when I heard that this video that allegedly exists that the prosecution has this syncing issue between the audio and video, I thought to myself, okay, well, that sounds like body camera video. But then the defense attorney said, it is several days long. And the prosecution really likes it. So then I started thinking, well, law enforcement, they have built-in protocols for downloading their body camera systems. And certainly on the biggest case to ever hit Moscow, Idaho, they are not going to wait days and days to download body camera video. So then I started thinking, what if the perpetrator wore a body camera system, especially because we know in the probable cause affidavit that the perpetrator allegedly was in proximity to the crime scene on at least 12 occasions prior to the murders. And what if the perpetrator wore a body camera during the commission of the crimes? The perpetrator had previously published a survey on Reddit asking criminals to relive their criminal experiences, tell him about their emotions while committing crimes, tell them what their planning was, what were they feeling while they were committing their crimes. If he was conducting a survey with that kind of interest, would that perpetrator want to relive his own crimes? Would he want to wear a body camera system while studying and casing the location so he could go back and look at it and prepare? And would he want to wear it during the execution of the actual murders? I think based on the fact that the defense attorney has said the prosecution really likes it, well, yeah, any prosecutor would like the actual crime on video.
Yeah.
And it certainly would make sense why there hasn't been that big of a fight or wasn't a big fight by the prosecution about tearing down the crime scene house. It has now been demolished and they really didn't fight it. You really don't need the house if you've got the entire murders on video. So there are people who think this big video, and the defense has come out and said, it's not a video of the car. They've said that in court. So it's not like a surveillance camera seeing the Elantra coming into frame and then going out of frame. And yeah. It's not along the circuitous route. It has nothing to do with the car. And because of the specific information given about the audio and video not syncing up, I really do tend to believe there's a high likelihood it could be a body camera system. So with that being said, when the prosecution is saying in this filing, there exists a compelling interest at stake to preserve a fair trial and no reasonable alternative exists but to conduct a closed hearing, they can't possibly talk about why this is still delayed or how much left they have to do on a body camera system, possibly worn by the perpetrator. They can't talk about that in open court and maintain a fair trial. Because anyone who hears, if that is in fact what this is, if people hear that he was potentially wearing a body camera while casing the house and possibly during the commission of the crime, I mean, no juror is going to acquit him. So I think it could possibly be a combination of factors, Sarah. I think potentially they are going to talk about some very damning evidence that hasn't been turned over yet as part of discovery. And I certainly think this video, whatever it is going to be a topic of discussion. And if the prosecution really likes it, like the defense says, it's a big deal. It's crucial evidence. But then on top of that, yes, I think the prosecutor is ticked off by what has all happened with these surveys and, you know, the shenanigans that have gone on there. And I think he does want to shut down any open court hearings so that nothing else can be manipulated to justify a change of venue. I don't know if the judge will agree or not. We'll have to see what's decided. But ultimately, there will be a hearing on May 14th. It's just a matter of whether it will be open or closed or not. And it will deal on whatever remaining discovery is left to turn over. Ultimately, the prosecution has until the beginning of September to turn over all discovery. And then that's the drop dead date on that. And then, as I mentioned, change of venue will be at the end of June. And I anticipate the judge most likely will grant a change of venue and that this most likely will get moved to Boise, Idaho.
Some real jaw-dropping moments. And the thing that kind of rings back in my mind is, and I don't think we've touched on it today when you're talking, is the perpetrator was actually, am I right in saying, a criminology student?
Yes, he was a PhD criminology student. He has his master's in criminal justice. He studied with one of the premier experts in serial killers when he got his master's in Pennsylvania. And now he had gone on to get his PhD and was out in Washington, 10 miles from Moscow, because that's right on the Washington-Idaho border. Now, let me tell you, professor that he studied under in Pennsylvania for his master's, Dr. Catherine Ramsland, she's premier expert. She wrote the book on the BTK killer.
Right.
And there are a lot of similarities between the Papa Roger character who was in some of the online forums talking about this case and the BTK killer. The BTK killer sent letters to newspapers kind of bragging about his crime. Well, Papa Roger did the same thing on chat forums, had knowledge on some things ahead of time that really only the killer would know, like the knife sheath being left at the crime scene. So there have been parallels made. Could the perpetrator be Papa Roger? And there are many people who think when we do get to trial, we will find out, because Papa Roger disappeared upon the perpetrator's arrest. So that is something people are watching. But this professor who wrote the book, and she's the expert, is it possible her student, the perpetrator, her former student, would want a book written about himself? And as a way to guarantee that, to have a video of the actual crime so that she could study it and he could tell her, well, here's what I was thinking when I attacked this person. I mean, is that the kind of thinking we're going to find? Because I always remind people, Most of what we know about this case is from the probable cause affidavit, and that is all pre-arrest information. That's all investigation prior to arrest. But if they found this video on his computer, on an electronic device, that would be post-arrest. We could have the biggest evidence in this case, not in the probable cause affidavit. It was found after arrest when the search warrants were executed. So we could have the biggest bombshell. It may not be the knife sheath. It may not be the DNA. It may not be the car. It may not be the phone. It could be this video. It could be the biggest bombshell.
Wow.
Here's what I think. I think it is a body camera system, and I think he was wearing it. And I've come flat out and said it. I don't have any reason not to believe that at this point. Based on my experience, when I have had to prepare for trials, and had to get body camera systems from local police who have responded to crime scenes on cases I've worked. It does take a while to get all that synced up and then to get your copies over to the defense as part of discovery and everything. And certainly, if this is several days long, you can imagine how much they have to study. Okay, what time did this occur? How did the perpetrator get there? What is he observing? What, you know, everything. You have to study it, but and then sync it up. And then listen, and, you know, everything will be analyzed. So I can understand why it takes so much time. And based on the comments made by the defense attorney, I almost feel, and maybe this is just me, but I almost feel like she's mentioning this for a reason, because she didn't have to bring it up in the January and February hearing. And I felt it was almost strategically mentioned that, hey, there's this really big evidence. And I almost feel like she's putting it out there that I'm going to do all my pretrial challenges. I'm going to try to get the search warrants suppressed and get as much tossed out and really try to give the perpetrator, make sure that everything I can do, I will have tried to do. But if the search warrants stand and all the evidence from the searches come in and nothing gets suppressed, I think at that point, the defense will be like many other defense teams in death penalty cases, where they go to their client and they say, all right, we have tried every avenue to get everything suppressed that we could. We've run out of options here. We could go to the prosecution now and ask them to take the death penalty off the table. Avoid a trial if you're willing to plead to four counts of first-degree murder. You would get life in prison without the possibility of parole, but we could spare you your life. Now, if you're a perpetrator who wants notoriety and wants to have people come interview you, you're going to want to live. Although you would live for several years, even if you did get the death penalty because of our appellate process, it takes years. But the perpetrator may say, yeah, I'll take that deal. Go ahead. Go try to plead this out. And would the prosecution take a plea or offer a plea at that point? I think they would, because one, you'd save an incredible amount of money. Number two, it guarantees this perpetrator wouldn't be acquitted and would be off the street. And for public safety, you just don't want to roll the dice when you're a prosecutor and get one hinky juror who could, you know, hang the jury, or God forbid, he gets acquitted. So that, to that, prosecutors like, they like guilty pleas. So that would be a motivation. Plus, the more time that goes on, memories fade, people die. It's harder to do trials several years out after these major events because, you know, it just takes a long time and people's memories fade. And if you don't get a conviction the first time, if you get a hung jury, you got to come back around and do it again. And then that's even longer. So I do think the prosecution would be interested in that. But then on the flip side, I say to myself, well, yes, the defense team might think, okay, this is the best we can do for our client. And getting the death penalty taken off the table would be a win for them as attorneys. They would consider that a win. But ultimately, the perpetrator's the boss. And if the perpetrator doesn't want to take a plea, the perpetrator has the right to go to trial. And if he has made a recording of the crime, that would have to be played for the jury. And that is something a very diabolical killer might want to have happen. We just saw it happen in a case in Alaska. So you got to think about the potential jurors that might see that, because that is something you're never going to be able to unsee. If in fact it exists. But that is what I'm thinking about and preparing for. And I feel so bad for these families, because there's coverage like mine where I'm coming out and I'm saying, I am considering this as a viable possibility that there could potentially be, if not the actual crime, the casing of the crime scene, all those videos would have to be seen. I think that'd be very, very upsetting for these families to know for months their kids were being, you know, cased like that.
Beyond, you know, when you're talking about the prosecutor getting to the point where there might be a plea, the thing that strikes me is I wonder what the families feel would be justice in this situation and how much they have as a voice.
Well, that is a very good point, because the family of Kaylee Gonsalves has come out. And her father said, don't even come to me with that question. I want the death penalty.
Right.
But they say that now.
Yeah.
It's a whole different situation when and if that question actually does come, you know, to fruition. Because how would they feel if the perpetrator is acquitted and goes back out into society and does this to someone else? I think ultimately the prosecution will canvass all four families of the victims and possibly even the roommates and to see how they feel about this. But I do think ultimately the prosecution, they don't work for the families. And some of these families are divorced and some parents may think differently. Some, like one may say, I want the death penalty, and the other parent may say, no, I don't. I want a plea deal. Ultimately, the prosecution doesn't work for the families. The prosecution works for Kaylee, Madison, Ethan, and Zanna. And if it means that no one else could potentially suffer the loss of life like those four did, they will take the death penalty off the table and take a plea or offer a plea deal. That's my opinion. Because for the prosecution, it just makes more sense all the way around. All the way around. And the families may not like it, but unfortunately, it's not realistic to think that it's not a likelihood. After the change of venue hearing, which will be at the end of June, then we'll know, okay, is this going to be in Moscow or is it going to be in Boise, Idaho? And then after that, we should hopefully get a trial date finally. And it's projected to be summer of 2025 at the earliest, assuming all discovery gets turned over by early September on that deadline and nothing backs anything else up. Now, that being said, then we go into pretrial motion phase. And a lot of information, in my experience, comes out through pretrial motions. That's when defense attorneys can almost do what they've already started to do is plant these little nuggets like, oh, there's this big video. They can start to put things out there so that the public can start talking about it and you get interested. So a lot of details can come out in these pretrial hearings. You also get a chance to see how the lawyers lawyer, and you really see who effectively questions well witnesses, how they organize their materials, how articulate they are. And I think you gain a lot of knowledge. So I am looking forward to that, because I think we're finally going to start hearing more details about the case, because so much has been kept under wraps due to the non-dissemination order that is in place.
Wow. Thank you, Jodine. Will you come back and join us with some updates as they come?
I would love to. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're so welcome. And remind everybody where they can find you. And can I just say also, just today, the penny dropped on why it's called Caught in My Web, your fantastic podcast, because of course you are Jodine Webber. What an idiot I am.
You're funny. Yes, my podcast is called Caught in My Web. It is on patreon.com 5 days a week. I cover breaking true crime news. So I cover all the other big true crime cases around the world. And then twice a month on Saturdays, I cover cold cases on the bonus catch level of Caught in My Web.
Thanks for listening. And if you want to know more, Catherine's book, Stop the Killing, is out now. For more details, go to catherineschweit.com. Please consider also supporting our independently made podcast. It's simple to do. Go to patreon.com/stopthekilling. And for as little as the price of a latte a month, you can be part of the solution to stop the killing. Patreon rewards range from official do-gooder status to ad-free episodes, autographed books, and opportunities to connect with us directly for your business, school, church, or even just a book club chat. But just knowing that you are part of a movement that has the power to make your community safer, well, that's got to taste better than a skinny cappuccino any day. So please head to patreon.com/stopthekilling now and polish off your do-gooder halo and make sure to include your name so we can give you a shout out. This podcast is a Conmunity podcast production. That's Con with an N. If you want more content, then head over to Conmunity Podcast at Instagram, where you'll find trailers on more binge-worthy true crime, like the award-winning podcast Conning the Con. And check out our show notes for all the links mentioned. Finally, if you want one takeaway action that you can do right now that can help make our community safer, please share, rate, and review this podcast wherever you listen. Everybody needs to know that they hold the keys to see something and say something. Together, we can stop the killing.
It's one of those things you hope never happens, but you better train for it. Because it will happen. And it will happen in places you wouldn't expect. Be ready for it.
Hello, and welcome to Guilty Greenie. I feel like we should start off this show by saying it's nearly impossible to be 100% sustainable given the current world we live in.
How do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. Not a great analogy for a vegetarian, but, you know.
We're talking about sustainability, maybe not the best analogy.
Don't eat the elephant is the first rule of the Guilty Greenie.
There's your first challenge of the week. Avoid elephants. What they used to call frugal is now considered sustainable.
That's such an aha moment. Frugal to sustainable.
You can save money and help the planet. That's going to be our new
tagline for sure.
Yeah, you can find Guilty Greenie on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcast platform you prefer. And join us in tackling the Guilty Greenie challenges. Until then, stay curiously green.
Hello, this is Dr. Grande, the host of True Crime Psychology and Personality. On my podcast, I explore and explain the pathology behind some of the most horrendous crimes and those who commit them. We discuss topics like narcissism, psychopathy, sociopathy, and antisocial personality disorder from a scientifically informed perspective. What is a narcissist? How do you spot a sociopath? What signs can you look for to protect yourself from these dangerous personalities? It's not just about the stories, but also the science and psychology behind them. So if you're interested in true crime or mental health, I'd encourage you to give my show a listen wherever you get podcasts.
You might be surprised to know that not all serial killers are straight, cisgender white men. And the victims of true crime are not a monolith either. She's Wendy and I'm Beth. And together we host Fruit Loop's Serial Killers of Color, a true crime podcast.
Together we take deep dives into the true crime stories about marginalized and minoritized perps and victims that often go untold.
We also provide the context and nuance that these stories deserve. At Fruit Loops, we're serving up true crime with a side of history, society, culture, and some fun.
Listen to Fruit Loop Serial Killers of Color on Spotify, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.